Greetings and salutations. We are Pop Culture.
Welcome back. Hey, folks. It is episode 62 of Pop Culture. I know, episode 62. Here we are in December. The wonderful holiday seasons are upon us again. And the title of this episode is called It's Good to Be King. The King. Good to Be the King. Folks, originally we were going to do two Christmas episodes, but we've really hit so much on Christmas in the last two or three times we've done this that I thought, you know what? Mel Brooks is turning 100, and the man deserves a little discussion as much as Norman Lear did when we did our Norman Lear. So that's what our topic is actually for the first episode of the month. But before I go any further, my name is Brian Burchett Ross, and I am your host here on the porch. And with me, as usual, I have
David Warr.
And I have
Ron Roberts.
And I have
Jeff Finlay.
And guess what, folks? We have
Robert Yeoman.
He's back. We have missed you. We have missed you, Bob. Welcome back to the porch.
Huzzah.
Welcome back. Hey.
Thank you.
It's a Christmas miracle, ain't it?
No. Carol Brady still can't sing.
So, gentlemen, it's been a while. How's everybody doing?
Excellent.
Good?
Well, no, we're good.
Actually, I'm a little disappointed when you said it's going to be King. I'm like, oh, Elvis. Awesome.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
We got to do an Elvis. We can do an Elvis one of these days.
I joke. I knew it was Mel Brooks.
Now, I have heard through the grapevine that someone listened to our episode, our Halloween episode. And
somebody actually listened to that?
Yes, and it's one of us. It's one of us live. The vampire episode I'm hearing is what we're talking about, which was an extremely – it was an episode. Dave, you have opinions on that episode.
Well, yes.
And you weren't there.
And I was talking to a fan.
Okay.
Oh.
Have a fan.
Yeah, you had a fan, and he's been a regular listener since about day one.
Awesome.
Okay.
Sorry, Walgreens is reminding me I have a prescription pickup. We are men of a certain age.
Yes, we are.
I'll silence this puppy. My nephew, and he said, oh.
Uh-oh.
And I said, the vampire episode, right? He said, yes. And I think we need to demand a do-over.
A do-over.
Because I can't believe you went an entire episode about vampires and did not talk about one of the most famous vampires in all of history, Grandpa from the Munsters.
Oh,
I mean, you even snuck the Addams family in there, and there's not a vampire in that single family as far as I know.
Not that we're aware of. No.
They're different types of people. They're ooky and they're kooky, but they're not bloodsuckers. I can't remember, but it's rare that a podcast gets me so worked up.
Oh my goodness!
I will let you know that was a quiz that I would have swept.
Really?
Well, it depends. Because Mr. Yeoman over here is quite the expert on vampires.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can postulate that Gomez Adams is a vampire because he's a lawyer.
Well, there we go.
Point taken, Bob.
But as wonderful as you all are, when Brian says, what do you think about Dracula? Well, we don't. Is not an acceptable answer. Do you watch What We Do in the Shadows? What? I mean, it's like, and which, by the way, Brian, I think is a brilliant show.
Oh, yes.
In fact, I rewatched it just recently, some of the episodes, and it's like, I just love this. It was a wonderful take.
Yeah.
But I'm petitioning for a do-over at some point.
Do-over. Well, we got next year's Halloween. I have no problem revisiting.
I do suggest, however, you start practicing those long.
and I would also just say that the information that we were given was spotty at best.
Yeah.
So Jeff and I are not miracle workers. We can only do so much.
It was not a well-prepared show.
This would have been one of those episodes, ladies and gentlemen, where I wish the cameras were rolling. Because the look on Brian's face as he was going through the Mexican history of vampires was priceless.
And Mexico is well known for its vampiric lore.
Yeah.
But you think they are vampires.
To any and all vampires out there, I apologize. And on behalf of the three men on the porch who were on that episode, yeah. Not one of our brightest moments,
I will say, but we laughed. You all had fun.
Oh,
we
my
did
gosh.
It. We did have something. Oh, we did it. We had something. Yeah. Well, gentlemen, you know what? Let's take the idea of vampires, and because there is a movie that we did mention called Dead and Loving It, which was created and written, and I don't know about written, but created by Mel Brooks. Yep. And that is a wonderful way to segue into our topic for today, which is the legendary EGOT winner himself, Mel Brooks.
Huzzah.
Yes. It's really interesting because I think Mel Brooks is one of those, because all of us on the porch here, we're of a certain age, one of us a little less than the others, but we all have the topics that we're a little bit stronger on than others. And I think Mel Brooks is truly one of those that we all can come together because we've all experienced, and I think enjoy the humor of Mel Brooks and the creativity of Mel Brooks. Some of us have actually been in productions of his musical, The Producers. Isn't that true, Bob?
Yes.
Yeah. So, of course, I don't have very much here.
Excuse me while I whip this out.
Oh, my God.
But we're going to just do a little. I'm just going to touch on a few things.
I thought we were talking about Carl Reiner.
Buck Henry.
That's next.
Oh, Buck Henry.
Buck Henry's a good one, too. So anyway, folks, so here's the thing. Brooks was born Melvin James Kaminsky on a tenement kitchen table on June 28th, 1926. So he's almost...
He has a park named after him, doesn't he?
Does he?
Kaminsky Park?
The family Kaminsky. I don't know if he's related.
Charles was... he grew up in Williamsburg.
You never know.
Williamsburg, which part of Brooklyn?
No. Oh, not Virginia.
No. Williamsburg, part of Brooklyn. Actually, 365 South 3rd Street,
they have
if you'd like to visit.
They have a bridge to it.
They do have a bridge to it. They have two, actually.
And a tree grows there, too, from what I understand.
Well, I was thinking, because isn't there the Williamsburg Bridge? And
But Williamsburg is actually...
Oh, my God. Now we're getting into Brooklyn real estate. Just go ahead and shut it off right now.
Maybe I'm wrong, but I think
well, you got Brooklyn, and then you got Manhattan, and then you got Williamsburg. I think. Let's see. His father's family were German Jews from Danzig, present-day Gdansk, Poland. Oh, my God, I've got to pronounce names again.
Outstanding.
His mother was a Ukrainian Jewish immigrant from Kiev. Let's see. He had three older brothers, Irving, Lenny, and Bernie. His father died. Seriously. His father died of tuberculosis of the kidney at 34 when Brooks was 2 years old. He said that about his father's death, there's an outrage there. I may be angry at God or at the world for that. I'm sure a lot of my comedy is based on anger and hostility. And I can see that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, a lot of his anger, or his comedy truly is. Brooks was a small, sickly boy who was often bullied and teased by his classmates because of his size. At 9, he saw Anything Goes with Ethel Merman and Victor Moore. After the show, he told his uncle that's what he's going to do. Instead of working in the garment district like the rest of his family, he wanted to go into show business. When he was 14, he gained employment as a poolside tumbler at the Butler Lodge, a second-rate Borscht Belt hotel, where he met an 18-year-old Sid Caesar. Brooke kept his guests amused with his crazy antics. He explained that one day he stood at the edge of a diving board wearing a derby and a large alpaca overcoat with two suitcases full of rocks and announced, "Business is terrible, I can't go on," before jumping fully clothed into the pool and sinking to the bottom. He was taught by Buddy Rich, who also grew up in Williamsburg, how to play the drums, and he also learned
Good
how
teacher.
To play the piano. Yeah. Did you know Buddy Rich?
I'm aware of who Buddy Rich is. Okay. Yeah, that's why I said he's a good teacher.
Let's see. During his teens, he changed his name to Melvin Brooks, influenced by his mother's maiden name, Brookman. And he didn't want to be confused with the trumpeteer Max Kaminsky.
Well, exactly. I mean,
yeah, I know. Who would? He intended to follow his older brother and enroll in Brooklyn College to study psychology. However, in early 1944, in his senior year of high school, he was recruited to take the Army General Classification Test and eventually was drafted into the Army in 1944. He was sent to Fort Dix, and then sent to the SS Sea Owl at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. In December 1944, he was transferred to the 1104 Engineer Combat Battalion as a combat engineer, and he participated in the Battle of the Bulge. I've never had that battle. Of his experience there, Brooks noted, they don't all fall, folks. Along the roadside, you see bodies wrapped. Along the roadside, you see bodies wrapped up in a mattress covers and stacked in a ditch. And those who would be Americans, that could be me, I sang all the time. I never wanted to think about it. Death is the enemy to everyone. And even though you hate Nazis, death is more of an enemy than a German soldier. That was his kind of take on during all that. He was stationed in two German-sounding towns. The battalion was responsible for... Not even going there.
And this is how the United Nations got started.
That's true.
Yes. His battalion was responsible for clearing booby-trapped buildings and defusing landmines. So, I mean, the man had a pretty intense job.
Yeah.
He said booby. I didn't hear a giggity. I was just saying
he's Ron sleeping. He'll be
sleeping. No. I'm just, let somebody else take a shot every once in a while.
Yeah. Brooks was tasked with landmine location. Defusing was done by specialists. Brooks has stated that when he heard Germans singing over loudspeakers, he responded by singing the American Jewish L. Jolson hit Toot Toot Tootsie Goodbye into a bullhorn. Yeah. So that was his response to that. He spent time in the stockade after taking an anti-Semitic heckler's helmet off and smashing him in the head with it. With the end of the war in Europe, Brooks joined the Special Services as a comic, touring Army bases, and was made an acting corporal put in charge of the entertainment and performed at Fort Dix. In 1946, Brooks was honorably discharged from the Army as a corporal. After the war, he secured a job as a clerk in Brooklyn Navy Yard. Well, Brooks got into a taxi, ordered the driver to take him to the Catskills, and that's where he actually spent his time working in various Borscht Belt resorts and nightclubs in the Catskill Mountains as a drummer, pianist, and eventually a comic, which makes sense because back in those days, I mean, that's where they all, Sid Caesar and, you know, all of them. In the years after the war, Brooks' hero was comedian Sid Caesar. Back in New York, Brooks would slink around trying to catch Caesar in between meetings to pitch jokes to him. And eventually, Caesar started throwing cash at him and taking some of the jokes. And at 24, Brooks got his break as a full-time writer. He then went into television. In 1949, his friend Sid Caesar hired him to write jokes for the Dumont NBC series, The Admiral Broadway Review. He wrote along with his eventual best and lifelong friend, Carl Reiner, also Neil Simon, Danny Simon, and Mel Tolkien. Danny Simon. No relation to Paul. The writing staff proved widely influential. Reiner, of course, created Dick Van Dyke Show and based Maury Amsterdam's character Buddy after Mel Brooks.
I didn't know that either.
I did not either.
Knowledge is spread.
Actually, that's what's important about this podcast, really. Likewise, the film My Favorite Year, 1982, is loosely based on Brooks' experiences as a writer on the show, including an encounter with Errol Flynn. And Neil Simon's play Laughter on the 23rd Floor is also loosely based on the production of that show, and the character Ira Stone is based on Brooks.
Can you back up a second? So was Brooks involved with My Favorite Year? Did ever say he wrote? Or
no.
Neil Simon wrote it.
No, that was... who did My Favorite Year? But it was somebody who knew Brooks and based that.
I thought you said it was Neil Simon that wrote it.
My favorite year. Neil Simon. Did Neil Simon write My Favorite Year?
No, I don't know. That's what I thought you said. Man.
Through the internet.
No. Anyway.
That I don't know.
Because I've heard a couple references to My Favorite Year, because you just referenced it, right?
Right.
My imagining.
Right.
Okay.
1982.
I have hallucinations. I'm not sure.
Thanks for sharing, Dave.
I'm just readjusting to time zones, folks. So I've been in the West Coast for a little bit.
Or yes,
not
has.
The West Coast, Las Vegas.
We have Las Vegas, Dave.
Yeah. And I'm sleepy. But because I've never liked My Favorite Year.
No.
And I've been hearing a couple references to it the past few weeks, so I'm thinking I need to revisit it. So
I thought it
I
was.
Saw this. This is one with Peter O'Toole.
Peter,
yeah, yeah, that's like, where yeah. he's drunk the whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
Alan Swan. No, yeah. Swain.
Yeah. So anyway, that's all. Just a personal note. I was thinking I need to revisit it and see if maybe my taste have matured enough where I would appreciate it today,
or just change. Let's see.
I think it was Peter Toole's performance that put me off in the movie.
It might have been. Brooks and co-writer Reiner became close friends and began to casually improvise comedy routines in October 1959 for Random House book. In October 1959 for a Random House book launch of Moss Hart's autobiography Act One at Mama Leone's, Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks performed, and that was the first time they performed the 2000-year-old man. Which kind of took off, obviously. They performed the routine for friends all the time, but in the late 1950s it gained a reputation in New York City, and they were invited consistently to clubs to just do the 2000-year-old man. In 1960, Brooks...
And for our fans who may not know the 2000-year-old man, it was basically an interview kind of thing where Carl Reiner was a straight man, you know, and asked questions of the Mel Brooks who played the 2000-year-old man, and of course his takes on history were
right. And it actually started with Reiner actually suggesting, "Let's talk to a 2000-year-old man who witnessed the crucifixion of Jesus Christ."
Yep.
So that was actually the kickoff of that. Anyway, then he moved in 1960 from New York to Hollywood without his family. He and Reiner began performing the 2000-year-old man on the Steve Allen Show. Their performance led to the release of the comedy album that sold over 1 million copies in 1961. They expanded their routine with two more albums, a revival in 1973, an animated TV special in 1975.
I remember that. Yeah, I remember that.
And
too.
A reunion album in 1998. Brooks was also involved in the creation of Broadway musicals, the musical All American, which debuted in 1962.
Classic.
I'd never heard of it.
No, of course not.
but it starred Ray Bolger.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, as a Southern science professor at a large university who uses the principles of engineering on the college's football team.
Huh. Okay.
With huge hits like...
Mr. Lamar... You use your tongue prettier than a $20 whore.
He also ran for 80 performances. Ooh. And received 2 Tony Award nominations.
Because it was Mel. Really?
Yeah. So,
never heard of.
Yeah.
Politics.
With comedy writer Buck Henry.
Ah, yes.
Brooks created a TV comedy show titled
Smart. Maxwell Smart.
Get smart.
Yep.
About a bumbling
still
James
funny
Bond.
Today.
By. I'll tell you what, I still love Get Smart. Did you ever see Get Smart, Ron?
Yeah. The movie sucked.
And no. The movies weren't.
Oh, no.
I didn't care for the movies.
No, you people.
When I
first saw the previews and saw Steve Carell, it's like finally someone who
I love Steve Carell.
The movie was a little uneven, but yeah. I thought it was worthy of a sequel. And I'm surprised it didn't get it because it did actually very well at the box office.
Sorry about that, Chief.
See, now I was thinking of the movies that Don Adams, who played the original Get Smart, did because they did
the nude
movies,
bomb.
The Nude Bomb, and
they did made for TV movies. I think the Nude Bomb was the only one that actually went into theaters, didn't it?
Yeah,
and didn't have 99.
Yeah.
No, oh, really? Didn't have 99.
Barbara Feldon wasn't necessarily.
Yeah, she did not want to.
But, you know, I loved Anne Bancroft as Agent 99. I liked the whole dance scene. I thought was hilarious. I enjoyed it. Like I say, there was some things that was like, okay. Mm-hmm. But I thought it still had the satire and everything that frankly, the character had. Mm-hmm. Now, unfortunately, It was based on, and I'm probably giving quiz things away, so never mind. I would say it was based on the TV show, but I do not believe that Buck Henry and Mel Brooks had an active role in the movie.
I don't think they did either.
No, they did not.
No, I didn't think they did.
They did not. And in fact, after the first year, Mel Brooks had nothing to do with Get Smart.
Well, I didn't know that.
I did not know
that. Well, yeah. His movie career probably. Or,
right. Yeah, at that point, he was taken off, and it was pretty much Buck Henry's baby.
Baby.
At that point.
And I always thought of Buck Henry as the force behind Get Smart. So.
Yep. And it did win an Emmy Award for Best Comedy Series 68 and 69 as well.
6-7, though.
And a very, 6-7. Very cool. I thought it, I really liked the theme.
Oh, yeah. Da-da. Oh, the theme. Da-da. Yeah.
That's all it takes to get people to smile and laugh.
Mm-hmm.
It's to sing that song.
Oh, yeah.
And they did it in the trenches in
1909. Hmm. Oh.
During,
I did not know.
I did not know.
During the press conference, the reporter asked Mel Brooks, "What are you going to do next?" And his reply was a little ditty I'm working on called "Springtime for Hitler."
Oh yeah,
Which started as a joke for him, but then of course turned into the movie "The Producers," which was actually not a hit movie.
No.
It was actually considered, it was panned by many and considered crass and insulting. And it was Peter Sellers who championed the film.
Really?
And he paid out of pocket to put out full-page ads in Variety and New York Times and
you,
all
you
that
know what?
To
and,
promote
and,
this.
And I like, the remake has all, I mean, because it's based on the musical.
Right.
But I think the original producers with Zero Mostel and Gene Wilder, to me, it was hilarious. It was just
maybe it was
you never seen it.
I've never seen the original producers.
What?
And
oh, really?
No. Robert Shaw as LSD.
Mm-hmm.
Hilarious. You got to see it.
It turned into a cult classic.
Yeah.
Is what it did, and it did propel Mel and
we have
the rest
to have
of
an episode just two great movies you didn't see when they were out.
You know, that would be one of them for
that
me.
Would be most of them we weren't alive.
Dick Shaw, not Robert Shaw. Dick Shaw.
But yeah, and it became a huge. Wow. It became a huge cult hit.
Yeah.
But it also propelled him to be offered a. Well, actually, his next one was called The 12 Chairs, which was a complete and utter bomb. It did. He was eventually hired to direct a little film in 1974 called Blazing Saddles. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
It sounds familiar.
which, of course, starred Cleavon Little, Gene Wilder, Harvey Korman, Slim Pickens, Madeline Kahn, Alex Karras, and Mel Brooks himself with cameos by Count Basie and Dom DeLuise.
Yeah.
My God, I love that movie.
That's a good movie.
And then, of course, he followed it up with a movie that Gene Wilder was working on and said, hey, I've got this little Frankenstein thing I'm working on. And Mel Brooks, and actually Gene Wilder said, I will do your movie if you help me with mine. And Mel Brooks, to this day, from what I read, is that he still states that Young Frankenstein is his favorite of all the movies he's ever worked on.
And it was kind of a hands-off type thing, too, for as far as appearing in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You
know, he didn't appear at all in that one,
no.
Did he?
Getting back to Blazing Saddles real quick. So my dad, I was too young to go to the theaters to watch this, I believe. But my dad went to see it, and he was usually like a one-and-done type thing. It was unheard of to go see movies 2-3 times just because it cost. I think he went back to see that 2-3 times, 4 times maybe, just because of the farting scene. I mean, such a unique, you've never...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you never had...
It was a taboo that had not been broken.
And it was rated R. I think it was rated R.
Well, and the funny thing is, they re-released it in the theaters, I remember, and I was 9. They re-released it over a summer. And I had a friend whose mother... it was just him and his mother. She took us at 9 to go see that movie. I felt like I was the coolest kid in the playground because I'm seeing this R movie. Now, I remember laughing my butt off to a lot of it. Of course, as I got older, I caught a lot more.
Schnitzengruben. And
but I think movies like Young Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles, especially, and probably High Anxiety, which was which came after, which was his nod to Hitchcock.
Yeah.
Those movies, in my opinion, were very much the precursor to the airplane movies.
Oh, I agree.
And the, you wanted to go back and see them because you were missing through the laughter and you know how fast the jokes were flying. Yeah. You were missing all that. Madeleine Kahn also was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress.
For Blazing Saddles?
For Blazing Saddles.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she was tired.
Tired. Tired of playing the game.
It's two. It's two.
It's my arm.
It's but anyway, yeah. So, and it was the second, Blazing Saddles was the second highest U.S. grossing film of 1974, grossing $119.5
million. 1974, that's a good year.
Yeah. The year someone came into the world.
Yeah, Blazing Saddles.
Yeah. Mm. Is that what you were called back then? I don't know.
And then
I'm trying. I'm just trying. This has been a while since I've been on this porch, guys.
Watch out for splinters.
Was that a husky saddle?
Bruce. Brooks described the film as a Jewish Western with a black hero.
What?
Yeah. And I really, you know, you guys know this, but for those seven of you out there listening, I really, really wanted to title this episode instead of It's Good to Be the King. I really wanted to title it, Hey Boys, Where Are All the White Women?
Oh,
because I just found that line, even the very first time at nine, I thought, oh, that's bad. Yeah. But that was funny.
So what'd you say? It was a Jewish, what?
He called it a Jewish Western with a black hero.
Yeah, I don't. I think maybe the Frisco Kid might have been more of a.
I don't.
He did Frisco Kid. Didn't he?
Are you talking the original serials? Was there a follow-up to the Frisco Kid?
When he played a rabbi in the West?
Go West.
What the heck was that called?
Go East.
Maybe it wasn't Frisco Kid.
You're chilling.
Oh, 1979 movie.
Brooks has said that the film has to do with love more than anything else. I mean, when that black guy rides into that old Western town and even a little old lady says, up yours.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, what did you expect her to say to you?
That you know that his heart is broken.
I stand corrected. So Gene Wilder was in it, so was Harrison Ford. But maybe
so it's really the story of that heart being mended. Mm. That's what he said it was always about, the heart being mended.
Heart being mended.
I didn't get that. Yeah, oddly enough, I did not like Blazing Saddles for a long time. For the same
year
reason,
ending.
The ending.
Yeah, right.
And apparently as a youth. I am private joke if you haven't watched
My Cousin Benny.
But anyway, I didn't like that fourth wall being broken.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so for same reason I didn't like Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Yeah. It was like everything's going fine until they break that fourth wall. It's like
a
fantasy. Once I'm taken into a world, I like to stay there, but not to give too much away, folks, but you'll find out if you watch the movie what happens. So
yeah,
I didn't mind it because it's a very funny movie.
I'm parked just around the corner.
I do seem to recall that when it first made it to television, though, that I didn't understand what was so great about the campfire scene.
Oh, I know, because everybody's standing up. There's no noise.
They took the joke out. It was just like people sitting around the campfire. It's like, okay, this isn't funny.
I know. Let's we're gonna get away from this for a little bit. This is what fascinates me about Mel, and what I don't. Well, let me put it out there as a question: could it be done today? In 1974. Mm. Here's an old. He was young at that point. But here's a youngish. He was in his 30s, probably. Young to me. A young Jewish Borscht Belt comedian. Who writes or uses the N word?
Right.
Who stereotypes absolutely everyone in this movie, including the black community, the Jewish community, the Native Indian community, cis white guys as they weren't called back then, but still, could a Jewish man write something like that now without the world going, that's not yours to write.
Saturday Night Live.
I don't necessarily. But
that would have the impact of trying to shock the audience.
I see what you're saying there.
Well, and of course, we have to remember back in one of the problems with the world back then was that the N-word wasn't the N-word. You know,
that's true. Well, it was right on the cusp.
So things have to change socially. I think a lot of stuff is product of its time, and that's what it was. Mm-hmm. So that there maybe you can't do a Blazing Saddles today, but we don't have to because we have Blazing Saddles. Does that make sense?
I see what you're saying there. What were you going to say, Ron?
I just think that you couldn't. I don't think it would matter if it was a Jewish person writing it or not. I don't think it could be done because the world has become so politicized that both sides would look to a film like that and say, see, this is what should be made, because they can say what they want and they don't care what anybody thinks about it. And then you have the other side saying, no, you can't say those things. So it couldn't just be pure entertainment. Mm-hmm. It would just become a political statement. And right. I don't think it's there. But I also think that Blazing Saddles is also overall a big setup of Hollywood.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, ultimately. I mean, as far as the stereotypes go, I mean, he's talking about this is what they did back in the 40s and the 50s. They had white guys play Indians and Chinese people. And I think to me, that's the bigger slap. I mean, is that he's saying, look at you. You know, we need to look at ourselves in the mirror and say, look how stupid this looks. Mm-hmm. This is what we've done for years. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it has anything to do with him being Jewish, if it could be done again. Yeah. I think the world has changed, and I think that everybody gets, and offended is not the right word, but people just can't look at things through a lens of the time, like Dave said.
And I would also, not to question Mel Brooks, but when he says a Jewish Western, it's like, I don't feel Judaism or that comes through at all in the Western.
Me either. Mm-hmm.
It's only Jewish because it was created by a person who was Jewish.
That's why I was questioning it.
So that's, but you know, he has to see the world through his lens.
Sure. Sure.
And which very much, you know, he fought in World War II. He was, you know, he lived in a different time.
He saw horrors that none of us. Horrors.
He served his country well.
Yeah.
Oh, he absolutely did.
But I mean, and he also was, he is, you know, hitting an anti-Semitic soldier on his side, you know, on the side of the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Over the head while fighting the Nazis. So, you know, he's fighting anti-Semitism on both sides.
Yeah.
Well, it's probably the same way the Negro soldiers during World War II had to. I mean, they're fighting the Nazis, but they're fighting a lot of the other.
Oh, their own the racism within.
Yeah.
Well, even the Civil War. I mean, you know that goes all the way back.
One other thing I think that our listeners need to understand about all this is so you have Mel Brooks, who is considered one of the greatest comedic minds of all time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, served in the war.
Yeah.
Think about that for a minute. There's an entire generation of athletes and entertainers who served their country.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. You had Mel Brooks. You had Ted Williams, famously. I mean, there's so many players in baseball that missed prime years of their career because they served. Mm-hmm. Now, some of them didn't actually serve, and they were more on the USO side of it, but they could not do their service. They couldn't play because they had to go into
Jimmy
the war.
Stewart gave up
Jimmy
his career.
Jimmy Stewart. Yeah. You had Don Rickles was in the Navy.
Yes.
So think about that. And you look at today, and now I'm going to get on my soapbox, but you look at like the YouTube generation and all these so-called celebrities and entertainers now.
Mm-hmm.
And if they had to get called into service, what would that be like?
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I totally agree.
So when we throw around the term greatest generation, it really was.
It really was.
Because that group of people sacrificed so much. For
and,
what we
they had just gone through a depression too,
right? Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
I guess I'd be curious. I mean, if we're getting a little off topic here, but I'd be curious to see what I don't know what the percentage of people who were serving in the military at that time must have been much higher than it is today.
Oh, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
You know, today it's a fraction of the population, whereas then I bet everybody knew a GI.
Well, sure. Part of that was because of the draft, too.
Well, not just the draft, but I'm just saying because of the war effort. There was volunteering, there was patriotism.
And there was a purpose. There was the fight, there was a good guy and a bad guy.
Yes. Okay, it was so, no
yeah,
gray
it was a
area.
Clear. Yeah, you know, Hitler was taking over the world. There was no ifs, ands, or buts.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But
absolutely.
I would you know tell everybody out there if you're interested in listening, look into that and just realize that you have some of these greatest names in entertainment history
and sports
and everything, and they dropped it all.
Yeah,
and it did deeply influence Hollywood as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Television, because you know, like today, can you imagine a TV show? You know, Get Smart was one thing with you know, making fun of the spy industry, but think about it. Don Rickles had CPO Sharkey.
Right.
We had Gomer Pyle. We had shows that made fun of the military.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
can't do that now.
You know, and now everything with the military is so serious. Sergeant Bilko. You know, it used to be because they had the experience. They knew what it was like on the inside, so to speak.
Sure.
You know, they knew that everybody in that was serving was human.
Yeah. Yeah. And as fallible as everybody else. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
And a lot of the writing came from people that really didn't have that much of a start in television, but war stories were just loosely translated, like with the Twilight Zone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Even Star Trek.
Oh, yeah.
Well, heck.
They're modified versions of the stories of war as they witnessed it.
Mm-hmm. In the 60s, I think every lead male character in a sitcom was a war veteran.
Archie Bunker was a war veteran.
Yes.
Well, so was Rob Petrie. So was Herman Munster. Yeah. All things. I mean,
they all went to become architects.
Yeah.
They did the GI Bill, went to whatever. And,
Well, it was never mentioned, but I imagine Ward Cleaver was too.
Yeah, you're right. True. But anyway, so I just thought that was interesting. It's like, but you know, there can be some serious discussion about that whole thing because life was so different back then, and you know the reality of where we were then. Anyway, so you know, he did Blazing Saddles, he did Young Frankenstein.
Yeah.
He did Silent Movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Only one word spoken in the whole movie.
Yeah, and it was by Marcel Marceau.
The mime.
Famous mime.
The mime, yeah.
And it was No. No. And that starred Dom DeLuise, Marty Feldman, Sid Caesar, Bernadette Peters. Cameos by Paul Newman, Burt Reynolds, James Caan, Liza Minnelli, Anne Bancroft, and of course Marcel.
The usual gang.
At that point, I think everybody was jumping on the Mel Brooks. Yeah. You know, the 70s was Mel's decade. I think that was pretty obvious. Then he followed that up in 77 with High Anxiety, which I think is for me, High Anxiety is just as good as the other two and doesn't get the acknowledgement, I think, that Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles gets. I think there are some hugely hilarious bits, but you got to know your Hitchcock to catch a lot of that. That's where that lies.
Not just the birds.
And not just the birds, no. And then in 1981... he did History of the World, Part 1. I was always on the fence with that one.
I was not a fan. I just didn't...
It was okay. It wasn't my favorite, but it was okay.
I thought there were some bits that were hysterical.
Sure. The beginning and the end of the movie were great. It was the thing in the middle.
It was that little thing in the middle.
That needed a little bit more workshopping. Yes.
I did. I mean, I loved the scene with the live chess pieces. You know, so-and-so, jump the queen. So-and-so, jump the queen.
It's good to be the king.
And it was narrated by Orson Welles in between his doing the fish stick commercials.
And the Muppet movie.
He didn't produce and starred in, but did not write or direct a remake of the 1942 film To Be or Not to Be. Mm-hmm. I remember going to see that and being totally blown away that this was not
a comedy.
Anything that I was expecting. But
didn't the original star, was it Jack Benny?
Jack Benny. Yeah. Well, during its time in the 40s, when it was filmed, it was that way.
Yeah, but it was intended to be a dramatic vehicle for Jack Benny, I think, originally.
Yes.
Yeah. But I ended up liking it, even though I was surprised that it was. And then in the next movie he directed in the 1980s, 1987, Spaceballs.
I'm combing the desert.
Yeah, there's a lot of airplane-type gags in there.
I... that was the moment for me that I watched that movie and went, well, his time is
past.
Oh no!
You don't like yogurt?
That is my
Super
absolute
accelerator tribe.
Yeah, that's
my least favorite. Yeah, my
I
least
have
favorite.
To say though, the bit where they rewind the videotape to see what happened. It was priceless, and then they're all watching, and they're just watching themselves. Watch. I mean,
did you get those pages? I didn't get the pages. Why don't I ever get the pages?
Surrounded by a bunch of assholes.
Yeah. That was good.
And what year was Spaceball?
That's your 1987.
Now I will say that it was done, and it should never be revisited. Josh Gad, I'm talking.
Oh,
to
I
you.
Know.
Oh,
I heard
stop
going,
now.
I don't know. Maybe.
No. In order to redo a movie, the movie has got to be fantastic.
Well, it's a sequel.
First,
it's not a redo. Sequel.
Well, even thing. Still, it's just not.
A sequel to a Star Wars type movie? That's not
heard of.
But Josh Gad is. Mel Brooks has given him the go, and they're in the middle of filming the next.
I know. They brought Rick Moranis back for it, too.
Uh huh. We're in the middle of doing it.
Meanwhile, Get Smart 2 languishes in development hell.
Yes, I know.
He said he was going to be with his kids.
Right, after his wife passed away.
In 1980. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Just as a comment, though, I just had to look quickly, but Airplane came out in 1980.
Yes.
And I think that's what, unfortunately, for better or for worse, influences these films that Mel Brooks did later.
I think so, too.
And I don't know how much, I wonder if it was Mel and how much was the studio saying, we need more of this.
More slapstick.
The more Zuckerman. Not Zuckerman.
Because you lost.
Zuckerberg.
To me, a lot of the films that get to the 80s and 90s. They are just formula.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. You know, the brilliance of a Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, was the fact that they, you know, Young Frankenstein didn't have silly jokes where Princess Leia is wearing cinnamon buns on her head.
Right.
You know, things like that, or a big helmet
stuff.
This is
how you get ants.
Yeah. No, I agree with you.
It was
a smarter humor.
It was
a smarter humor.
Yeah.
And, I mean, smarter being a relative term.
Right.
But still, it wasn't. There was some thought to it. Yeah. But, you know, they acknowledged things like that.
Yeah.
They made fun of it.
It wasn't just like, okay, we're just, how many sight gags can you see here now?
Right. Yeah. Right.
It was a lot of sight gags became later in.
I totally agree with you, and you're probably right. That probably it would, Airplane and all that influenced those later ones.
It's probably in your notes as well, but about Men in Tights that came up. It was same type of thing.
Men in Tights.
It was kind of more of a. It was more of a spoof of the Robin Hood thing,
it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
And it was supposed
it was sight gags again. It was not.
But I found that one a little funnier.
Latrine.
I don't know why. I enjoyed. Maybe it's because I enjoy the mythos of Robin Hood anyway, but I really did like Men in Tights. It's not a Blazing Saddles, high anxiety type movie, but compared to Spaceballs, I think it went up just a touch more. And it did have Patrick Stewart at the end, it had one of my favorite lines, because I am not a fan, as some of you know, of anything Kevin Costner. So I did like it, the one line when he says, I play Robin Hood with a British accent that sticks, or however. You know, I thought, that's nice. But 1993, he did Robin Hood, Men in Tights. He also, in 1989, made another attempt at television with the sitcom The Nut House, featuring Harvey Korman and Cloris Leachman. I don't remember
that at all.
I don't remember that.
Which probably explains what happened to Nut House. None of us remember it.
None of us remember it. But he also, speaking of Robin Hood, and I didn't mention it before, in 1975 he did create another TV show, which I do remember, and I enjoyed it, but it did not last long.
When things were rotten. Yeah, I remember that one.
When Things Were Rotten, which was
not
one of his.
Bad, but really fun.
But
I do remember
it
that.
Was.
It didn't last very long.
No.
But it was.
I thought it was funny. Life Stinks was a financial and critical failure, and notable as the only film Brooks directed that is neither a parody nor a film about other films or theater. Life Stinks, I don't remember that one. I know it was a drama, it was heavy, but I don't think I went and saw that one myself. Other than that, he met his first wife, Florence Baum, in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes on Broadway. They married in 53, divorced in 62, had three children. Then he ended up marrying, what's her name, Anne Bancroft in 1964. They remained together for 41 years until her death in 2005. Yeah.
It's been that long.
Yeah. They met at a rehearsal for a Perry Como variety Christmas show in 1961. It said from that day until her death they were glued together. He has remained single since she died and stated in 2023, once you are married to Anne Bancroft, others don't seem to be appealing anymore. Which I thought is very sweet. His handprint on the Walk of Fame, Hollywood Walk of Fame, has an extra digit because he wore an extra digit so that he could have six fingers.
That's funny.
Oh, funny.
Also, one that we haven't mentioned yet, which he hardly ever gets mentioned for, is The Elephant Man.
Oh, yes, yes.
Produced.
Oh, he produced The Elephant Man, that. Yeah. I didn't go down all the stuff he produced.
Seriously.
Oh, wow.
Not just for
did not know that.
Yes, no,
I didn't know that either.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep, he sure did. Hit it, Julie.
Getting to know you, getting to know all about you.
Thank you, Julie. Hey, sorry, Julie. I know it took you a long time. I ran long because I had these stupid facts. So here's the question, folks.
They don't teach you.
Stupid facts that we don't do anymore in this country, but whatever. So let's go around the table. Favorite Mel Brooks movie. Let's start with, hey, Bob, you're back on the porch. Start with you, Bob. What's your favorite Mel Brooks movie?
Who you have to blank to get a job in this town?
It's the producers.
The producers.
Now, the movie or the musical? Or both?
Both.
Both?
Both have individual joys in them.
All right.
And most of them are from really bad gay jokes. But they're freaking hilarious when you watch it.
I got to see the I got to watch The Producers someday. I really do. At least the
Oh, you never saw the movie?
I never saw the movie.
Oh my gosh, it's funny. It's hilarious.
What about you, Dave?
Well, now I'm questioning whether it is a Mel Brooks movie, Young Frankenstein.
It is. It's considered his third movie, and he did help write parts of it with Gene.
Yeah.
So,
but I really liked Young Frankenstein. And he did the Broadway show with it too. So
yeah.
But it's really sounds like it was a collaboration at least with Gene Wilder. But
yeah.
When I think of Young Frankenstein, I think of Mel Brooks.
Yeah, I do too. Actually, what about you, Jeff?
Yeah, Young Frankenstein. It's the one I remember seeing at the movies. Mm-hmm. I think it's the only Mel Brooks I saw at the movies. Blazing Saddles was great, but I think Young Frankenstein.
What about you, Ron?
I'm going to say Blazing Saddles, Brian, but I would, with a caveat, like to say that my favorite scene, though, is the blind hermit from Young Frankenstein. And if I could, real
Gene
quick, just jump
Gene
in
Hackman,
to Gene
yeah.
Hackman. I'm a little bit of a freak for Gene Hackman.
Sure.
He played tennis with Gene Wilder and every weekend, and he said, hey, is there a movie? I want to be in your movie. Is there a part? He's like, well, there's this hermit that we can put you in for. And so, and Mel Brooks was shocked that Gene Hackman, because he was a very serious actor, came in and he did this. And Gene Hackman had asked, hey, is there a few things I can improvise? Can I just try some things? And Brooks was like, sure, go ahead. So the line of, where are you going? Mm-hmm. I was about to make espresso was an ad lib.
Yes.
And Gene Hackman was uncredited in the movie, and it is rumored that he did it without pay.
Really?
Just because he wanted to do the movie so well. So, but yeah, that to me is my favorite scene, but Blazing Saddles overall.
I know. Yeah.
What about you, Brian?
Thanks, Ron. I have to go with Blazing Saddles as well. And I do. I will say I think of those big, what I consider the big three, Saddles, Frankenstein, and High Anxiety, are the big three. I think Young Frankenstein is the best written, best done. I think it's the top, but Blazing Saddles will always be my personal favorite. Yeah. I've always, there's just something, maybe it's because I was a 9-year-old boy who got to go see it at the theater. That gives it a
potty.
Yes. That gives it more sentimental to me, but, I truly love when they're punching that poor old woman. And she's I just absolutely love it.
You know, when they aired that on TV, because they had to probably cut a lot of stuff out, they put scenes in that were probably deleted from the original movie. Right. I go, what the heck is this?
Oh, yeah. Well, have you seen that meme that says Blazing Saddles will be appearing on TV tonight at 8 o'clock. It'll end at 8:05. <'Cause it's> like... But, yeah, I don't know. I think Mel Brooks will go down. I can't think of anyone nowadays. And, of course, I'm almost a 60-year-old man, so I don't pay attention to the comedians like I did then or the creators of stuff. But, again, like Norman Lear, like Carl Reiner, Mel is a legend in his own.
Absolutely.
That I don't think anyone nowadays has ever created anything that is so original, so different, and has brought so many.
I think part of that is because Hollywood, I mean, it's always been a business, but now it's a corporate business.
Yeah. International.
It's gotten so big. Mm-hmm. I've always maintained that, without any knowledge whatsoever, folks. So, but my gut has always told me that it's basically it's still a small community. The trick is once you break into that community, now you can be everywhere. You know, when you have people, when you have certain there's some star I've never heard of who's been in three movies that had huge box offices this year, for example. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, I don't know who this kid is.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have that kind of star power that we used to see because the community has expanded.
Mm-hmm.
And again, because of this international, you know, it's just too big.
Yeah.
You know, they don't make smaller movies. Young Frankenstein wouldn't be made today, not because it's not a good concept and everything, but because it's not going to be big enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, they're trying to fill movie theaters. So what the transition that we're seeing, of course, is to the these other smaller movies going directly to streaming services.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
And
right.
There's some excellent stuff that's going out onto Netflix and to Apple.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Apple Plus, whatever they're calling it today, to HBO or HBO Max or Max
HBO
or
Max
whatever. They keep changing their names.
I know.
And so that seems to be the space for the more creative endeavors, whereas, you know, the box office, we got, for example, when we're recording this, Wicked for Good just opened.
Right.
You know, that's a big spectacle.
Right. That's what they want in the theaters.
And Running Man is out there now, which is a remake of an Arnold Schwarzenegger flick from whatever.
Which is written by...
But again, it's going to be another big spectacle. It's not going to be... you're just not going to... You don't find those small movies anymore.
And that to me is...
Had a gobbler, you know, $15,000 at the box office or whatever.
Yeah. And that to me is what... Again, we'll do the old guys on the porch. And that is a crying shame because back in our day, especially the 70s, 70s was huge for movies that you threw them in the movie theater because you never knew what audiences truly wanted to see. So something like Blazing, I mean, you had your Godfathers, you had your Jaws, you had your Star Wars, but you had movies like Blazing Saddles and Favorite Time of Year or whatever you had the smaller movies that... found a following.
Yeah, there were 16 screens and they all showed something different.
Yeah.
It wasn't
two or three.
Exactly.
Well, and so I had one time, I had envisioned that should I ever be able to retire, I would spend a lot of time at the matinees.
Mm-hmm.
I don't envision that anymore because there aren't that many movies I want to see.
I know. Yeah. I know.
I agree.
Yeah. It used to be something good was coming out every week.
Yeah. And it
that's what I say.
I think Mel Brooks has done a lot to bring a comedy to the theaters that are unmatched, and I just everything we had just done talking about as far as you know what movies show now. I've got to believe he's sitting back saying, "Man, what crap?
What the hell's going on now?" Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with you. Totally agree. Anybody else? Any last words about Mel?
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. Glad he came our way.
I think life experience shows that it matters.
Yes, I hear you.
Well, and he has lines that people are still quoting in his movies.
Oh, yeah.
Now, what I mean by that is if you look at all the facts that you laid out about this man's life, and it totally influenced what he created.
Oh, yeah.
That's
yeah.
what I'm saying. Okay. Life experience matters.
Matters. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's like
absolutely.
Billy Joel.
I mean, and maybe for better or for worse, again, or for worse, probably, the current generation, you know, good luck, Gen Alpha.
Is that what they call it now?
You know, well, that's the group that's growing up now. That's the mobile generation.
Yeah.
If you look at all your, you're getting all your experience online, you're not getting experience. You're regurgitating someone else's experiences. Yeah. And frankly, you're only seeing the best of those experiences because nothing goes onto YouTube until it's been edited.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
Much like this podcast.
Yes. Yeah. Can you imagine what we cut out?
That's
this is what makes it
true. Anyway, we want to do a quiz?
Let's do a quiz.
Sure. Some,
are there big Debs in the room?
I think
that cabbage again.
I do think I sense a change in the force here. It is
broccoli.
It is almost Christmas time.
It is almost Christmas.
It is almost Christmas.
Do you know
Christmas
they sell individual holiday trees now?
I know.
Well, these aren't individuals, gentlemen. These are the Christmas trees.
Why isn't she in some festive?
Look how many Santa's eating. Because, he's got like a whole plate of
because
them.
Because Santa's on there, and Santa has to be like, look, little Debbie, she wants to be on the good list. So she's in the corner in her little check shirt, as always. Mm-hmm. And Santa is uh-oh.
Hey.
And there's Santa. Look at that. Those Christmas tree cakes, friends, are phenomenal.
I love them.
Yeah. Brought to you by the McKee Family Bakery.
Surprising amount of salt, but it just makes it that much better.
Really?
I have no pen.
Now, see? Oh, wow. Now, look at. Oh. Very interesting on the
they
back
have
here.
They have Christmas
there's
Nutty
the Christmas
Buddies.
Tree cakes through the decades. So you used to have just a little Debbie McKee trees. You had the snowman type character. Then you had a couple of snowmen, a snowman family, and then you got Santa looking really decked out there. But yeah, this is awesome. Wow, I sure hope I win these. I won't. Jeff,
I won't
you
either.
Go.
Jeff, there you go, right. Jeff. Share, please share. There's only like six in there, though, Santa.
All right.
I still think
there's five snack cake.
All right,
and
gentlemen.
I tell you, that's still one of the, I wish they sponsored us, because
that is
still one of the best deals on the snack aisle.
Actually, oh, I agree. Come on, little Debbie, and sponsor us. We're
40 years of the Christmas tree cakes.
Come on, Big Deb.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
All right, we're going to start with Bob again. Bob, you are the man of the hour. We're going to start with you. Number one, Bob. How many children does Mel Brooks have? A, 3, B, 4, C, 5.
A1 was what?
A was 3.
That's what I like.
Okay.
I think I counted 3. A.
I thought you said 3 with this. Yeah, a couple. Yeah, 3.
That we know of?
How many children does Mel Brooks have? 3, 4, or 5?
I'm going to go with 3. Wow.
4. I did not mention that he had one son with Anne Bancroft. He had 3 with his first marriage.
This guy over here.
Withholding the facts.
But he had his fourth. He had a son, Max.
But we all missed it, so it doesn't count.
That's true.
Okay, that's true.
All right.
Dave, you're next.
So
number
we all
2.
Should just answer every question the same. See what happens at the end.
Yeah, let's see what happens at the end. Number 2. How many grandchildren does he have?
What are we
doing? Oh, good Lord.
Here?
I have no idea.
A2. Well, you're about to find out. A2, B4, C7.
4 kids. I think 7's reasonable. I'm going to say 7.
All right. Jeff, 2, 4, or 7?
I'll say 4.
And Ron?
2, Brian.
And Bob?
7.
Ron got it with 2. Only 2 grandchildren.
Only 2. Wow.
Only 2.
His kids don't fool around?
Kids, obviously.
Mel was busy. His kids weren't.
Yeah, that's true. Number 3, Jeff. What did Mel win his first Grammy for? A, the musical book of the producers. B, the long-form video for the producers. Or C, comedy album, The 2,000-Year-Old Man in the Year 2000.
Oh. Well, I was about ready to say 2,000-year-old man, but I've been in the year 2000?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say what was the first one of the producers?
The musical book of the producers.
I'm going to say that one.
Okay. Ron, Grammy for the musical book.
I'm going to say C, Brian.
Comedy album, 2,000-year-old man, and Bob.
3,000-year-old man.
Okay.
C.
It was C. His first Grammy was a lot later
in life. Totally throws me off.
Yeah, well, my job here is done.
I think they gave him the award because they figured he was probably close to there.
And he's not.
I think it was 2000.
25 years later.
25 years later, he's still around. Oh,
he's still collecting residuals.
Which of these did he not get nominated for an Oscar for screenplay?
All of them.
Wow, these are hard.
A, The Producers. B, Blazing Saddles. C, Young Frankenstein.
I'm going to go B, Brian, Blazing Saddles.
All right. And Bob?
Young Frankenstein.
And Dave?
Young Frankenstein.
And Jeff?
I'm going to say... You said what was it, Producer?
Producers, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein.
Blazing Saddles.
Blazing Saddles. Woo-hoo! He did get one for Young Frankenstein because he did help write it. So Ron and Jeff. Hey, Jeff, you're on the board finally.
Yeah, hey, woohoo!
Wow, okay. Who's Bob? Bob. What sitcom did he guest star on that won him an Emmy? Was it A, Mad About You, B, Wings, or C, Will and Grace?
A.
Mad About You?
Mad About You.
Yeah, Mad About You.
I'm going to go Mad About You, Brian.
You're all mad about him. Yes, indeed. Look at
Carl Reiner, I believe, also played Alan. What was Rob Petrie's boss? Alan.
Alan.
God, no, I can't think of it either.
But anyway.
He played him. Yeah.
He played it as the character from the Dick Van Dyke Show.
God, I can't remember that listening now. Where are we at now?
Dave. Alan Brady.
Number six, Dave. In what year did he win the Tony for Best Musical? A, 2000, B, 2001, or C, 2002?
I think it was 2002.
Okay, Jeff. 2000, 2001, 2002.
I said 2001.
All right.
I'm going to go with the same year as the Grammy, 2000, Brian.
All right. And Bob.
2002.
Jeff got it with 2001. Ooh, Jeff's. Okay.
That was a space oddity.
No, number seven. It's you.
Jeff.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Yeah, it's me.
Okay. Name the movie from this quote. You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land, the common clay of the New West. You know, morons.
Blazing Saddles. Oh, sorry.
Now you're doing Dave's bit.
You pulled a Dave.
Blazing Saddles,
Blazing
to be or not
Saddles.
To be your high anxiety.
Oh, I thought it was... No, Blazing Saddles. I apologize.
I'm going to say Blazing Saddles, Brian.
Yes. That's the one.
Blazing Saddles.
You got it.
We all knew that anyways.
Yep, you all got that one. I thought I'd give you a little nice easy one. Okay. Again, what is name the movie that this quote came from? I beeped. Take me away. Take me back to Russia. Put me in irons. I beeped. The mad beeper is loose. Take away the beeper. Take me away. A, To Be or Not to Be. B, Life Stinks. Or C, High Anxiety.
I'm going to go High Anxiety, Brian.
All right. Ron's got a little high anxiety in him. What about you, Bob?
What were the choices?
To Be or Not to Be, Life Stinks, or High Anxiety?
Life Stinks.
And Dave?
I'm going to say Life Stinks.
And Jeff?
High Anxiety.
High Anxiety is Woo-hoo! The winner there. So Ron is still in the lead. Jeff is following up by one. And Bob and Dave are still in the game. Okay.
Bob,
who did Mel Brooks want for the sheriff originally in Blazing Saddles? A, Flip Wilson, B, Richard Pryor, or C, always was Cleavon Little?
Repeat again.
Who did Mel want for the sheriff first in Blazing Saddles? A, Flip Wilson, B, Richard Pryor, or C, Cleavon Little always?
A.
Flip Wilson.
Richard Pryor.
And Jeff?
I'm going to say Richard Pryor.
And Ron?
Richard Pryor, Brian.
It was Richard Pryor.
They wouldn't insure him because of the drug use.
You got it. So let's see. One for Dave, one for Jeff, and one for Ron. All right, who's up next? Dave. Number 10, which movie did Gene Wilder claim was his favorite of the ones he had done? A, The Producers, B, Blazing Saddles, C, Young Frankenstein.
Young Frankenstein.
Jeff.
I'm going to say Young Frankenstein.
And
I'm going to say The Producers, Brian.
And Bob.
Young Frankenstein.
It was Young Frankenstein. Ooh, Jeff has tied it up with Ron. Number 11. What movie is this quote from? Forget the ring. The ring is Bupkis. I found it in a Cracker Jack box. A, Spaceballs. B, Life Stinks. Or C, Robin Hood, Men in Tights.
Spaceballs.
Spaceballs.
And Bob.
Spaceballs.
And Spaceballs.
You got it. Look at that. Look at that. Ron and Jeff are still tied. And okay, boom. All right, Ron. Which of his movies did he lead? He was the lead, but he did not direct. A, Life Stinks. B, Dracula, Dead and Loving It. Or C, To Be or Not to Be?
To Be or Not to Be.
And Bob?
Dracula.
And?
My mind wandered. Could you repeat the question?
which of his movies did he lead but not direct? Life Stinks, Dracula, Dead and Loving It, or To Be or Not to Be?
To Be or Not to Be.
Yeah, I was going to say To Be or Not to Be.
To Be or Not to Be. That is it. So, Jeff, boom, and Dave, boom. All right, who's up next? Now we're totally lost.
Thanks, me.
Yeah.
Okay, Dave. What was the name of Robin Hood's blind sidekick in Robin Hood, Men in Tights? Was it A, Blinken, B, Winken, or C, Nodden?
I think it was Blinken.
Jeff, Blinken, Winken, or Nodden?
Oh, gosh. Winken.
And Ron.
I'm going to go Nodden.
And Bob.
The first one.
Blinken. Who else said Blinken? And Dave and Bob got that. Ooh, this is exciting. Number Jeff. Which of these movies was Harvey Korman not in? A, History of the World Part 1, B, Young Frankenstein, or C, High Anxiety?
Young Frankenstein.
Young Frankenstein.
Bob?
Young Frankenstein.
It's Frankenstein.
Nice. Okay. Ron. After escaping Roman soldiers in History of the World Part 1, what does Comicus do? A, build crucifixes, B, take care of the lions, or C, wait at the Last Supper?
Wait at the Last Supper.
Bob.
Wait at the Last Supper.
Sure. Wait at the Last Supper.
Last Supper.
It was the Last Supper. Yes, indeed. Wow, I'm telling you guys, Jeff and... Going to be close. All right, last question, Bob.
What's his net worth? At
no.
Oh. You had the...
Oh, he's not
I looked it up. You have to ask the question.
He's not dead.
He's not dead. I'm not doing that. Number 16.
I asked Alexa this morning.
Bob, here's your last question. Who plays a torture victim in the Inquisition segment of Mel Brooks' History of the World Part 1? Was it A, Sid Caesar, B, Jackie Mason, or C, Dom DeLuise?
The first one.
Sid Caesar.
Dom DeLuise came to mind as soon as you started asking the question, so I'm saying Dom DeLuise.
And Jeff, is it Sid Caesar, Jackie Mason, or Dom DeLuise?
Jackie Mason.
And Ron.
Jackie Mason.
And we have a tie, folks, between Ron and Jeff.
Oh,
I can see
there's Dom blood DeLuise in the water.
So, just to make it quick, because as usual, you know...
he had a funny accent and everything.
Number 1 through 20.
Oh my gosh.
Whoever gets the closest to the number gets them. So, Ron, number 1 through 20.
13.
And Jeff.
9.
The number was 20.
Ah!
So, Ron, Congratulations, you got the Christmas
case. The crowd goes wild.
And that is our Mel Brooks, the first of our two-parters, or our two episodes two-parter. Of the month. Not two-parters. Two episodes of the month. Hey, though, folks, we are coming back in two more weeks.
Expired.
With,
I'm kidding.
Just like my career.
Which year?
We're going to come back with a Christmas episode. We are going to talk about Rankin and Bass, the Christmas shows of Rankin and Bass, or as I like to call it, how we made Santa look like a total D-bag.
Oh.
So, they did.
Oh, okay.
Rudolph.
The coach should have been in this band.
Well, him too. They all were. Anyway, so until next time, folks, I want to thank you all. I want to thank the people here at the Ellis Reference and Library Center. I want to thank Impact for helping us drop these, and I definitely want to thank these four gentlemen who come back on the porch. God, it's good to have you back, Bob. It really is.
Thank you. Good to be back.
And until next time, as usual, stay off our lawn.
It's true. It's true. It's true.